Talking History on News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at the home of classical democracy, ancient Athens, and we'll be exploring how the city-state became a cultural as well as a political icon. Athens was the greatest city of antiquity, and its rise to preeminence followed a rapid demise that has been described as the greatest of all Greek tragedies. In tonight's show, we want to explore how Athens transformed the world, a city-state whose democratic revolution inspired future generations. Named after the goddess Athena, Athens became a cultural icon as well as a political entity, and its legacy is still felt today in the 21st century. In the time of Pericles, in the 5th century BC, Athens experienced what has been called a golden age. The Parthenon was built, and there were innovations in the arts, philosophy, and drama. But the rise of the Macedonian Empire brought this story to a tragic end. So in tonight's show, we want to explore the history of Athens in ancient times and how it became a cultural icon today. And I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dr. Martine Kuipers lectures in the Department of Classics at Trinity College Dublin, where she teaches Greek language and Greco-Roman literature and culture. And Professor Brian McGing, Emeritus Professor of Greek at the Department of Classics at Trinity College Dublin. You're both very welcome. Later on in the show, I'll be talking to Robin Waterfield, an independent scholar and translator who lives on a small olive farm in southern Greece. And he's the author of Athens, a History from Ancient Ideal to Modern City. We'll also be talking to Dr. Richard Stoneman, Honorary Visiting Professor at the University of Exeter and the author of A Traveller's History of Athens. And towards the end of the show, we'll be talking to George Sarah-Nicolau, the Director of the Earth Institute's Office of Academic and Research Programmes at Columbia University and the author of Facing Athens, Encounters with the Modern City. And he'll be talking to us about the impact of ancient Athens on the city today. But Martine, we might begin with you, and we might begin with something that has always intrigued me, and that's whether people at the time thought that they were experiencing a golden age of culture and democracy and civilization, or whether this was only something that was applied to the period in the centuries afterwards.
It's a little bit of both, Patrick. It's definitely authors like Thucydides, who were writing at the end of the 5th century, were sort of creating a picture of Athenian, sort of like a special status for Athens. In Pericles' funeral oration at the beginning of book two of Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War, it is definitely the case that Pericles is creating like a eulogy of Athens as a special place, which is not like any other place. That's work, or that moment in time is the moment of Athenian Athens is its largest political power, where it is ruling effectively an empire, even if you're not allowed to say that, because it is really an empire. And Athens has like a high level of wealth, a high level of political power, a high level of military power. And they're definitely aware that they are that powerful. But Thucydides is sort of like codifying that in his History of the Peloponnesian War at the very time. Part of the story, however, is also that so from the Hellenistic period onwards, Athens becomes a sort of cultural icon. So people are looking back in a period when Hellenism has become more like a cultural identity. They're looking back to Athens as a cultural center of the Greek world at a time when Hellenism has just become like a cultural identity which is spread over the entire Eastern Mediterranean and the Near East.
Brian, it's very interesting the way Martine used the word empire there, because that's not a word we normally associate with ancient Athens. We think of Athenian democracy and we think of the Parthenon and we think of this being a great civilization that inspired future generations. But we don't think of the darker aspects to it, the military power that Martine was describing.
Yes, she's quite right, of course. It did have an empire and they admitted it. They loved it. They said, "No, we like this, and we're gonna keep hold of it." Actually, thank you very much. So they weren't apologetic at all, and that I suppose is part of the brashness about the Athenians that the Spartans didn't like. They didn't like all that showy stuff. But there were dark parts of ancient society. I mean, slavery. It was a slave owning society, as I suppose was the United States in the end of the 18th century. No past is perfect. Treatment of women. Women were excluded from the governmental system. And there is this element of brutality. I mean, during the Peloponnesian War, Martina was talking about, there are some very brutal episodes where the Athenians decide to just wipe out certain populations. They don't entirely do it, but these are not particularly nice people. So as well as that great picture of civilization and drama, they produce these wonderful plays and build beautiful buildings. There's a much rougher side.
Which is interesting, because we normally associate the Spartans with the military aspects and the Athenians with being the civilized, more cultured ones that we can relate more to. But actually, it's not as clear cut as that. Brian, would you be able to talk us through maybe the rise and fall of the Athenian city-state? Because I read different kind of accounts and versions. Some put the downfall down to the Peloponnesian War. In others, it was to do with Macedonia. That there are kind of disputes about, with different people pinpointing when things went wrong for the Athenians.
Well, part of the problem, I suppose, is modern scholarship. It likes to divide things up into periods. And the end of the Peloponnesian War, that's the war that Athens and all her allies fought with Sparta and all her allies. I mean, it was a pan-Hellenic war that stretched over to Sicily as well, of course. Peloponnesian War doesn't bring anything to a close, actually. It's the 4th century, that is the century after the great period of empire in the previous 100 years. And the 4th century is in many ways the strongest period of Athenian magnificence, and it is the central period of the Athenian democratic system. That's when we see it working at its best. So it's what brings there isn't really an end of Athens. It continues as a city and as a highly civilized place. Romans visit it. There's a university there, education, rhetorical schools. So it retains a tremendous existence, but it's eclipsed, I suppose, in the eyes of later people by the rise of Macedon, first of all, and then by the rise of Rome. And the Romans always had some difficulty with the Athenians. They had a bit of a chip on your shoulder about the inferiority to the great literature, particularly. They were a bit sensitive about that. But it's the Macedonians, really, that is the rise of Alexander the Great and the kings that follow. That really brings the Athenian democratic system to an end, although it revives in different ways. It's just that Athens is no longer a major political player. That's when things come to that particular end, but not literary and not academic, not intellectual. It retains its importance as a center when Martina, certainly into Roman times. Alexandria becomes more exciting in some ways in the 3rd, 2nd centuries BC.
Martine, Brian there compared it to the United States, where, of course, there was slavery up until the Civil War in the 1860s. Could you compare it, I wonder, to the British Empire? Are there any similarities between what Athens was doing and what Britain then was to do in later centuries?
I think that's a very good comparison to make in many ways. If you're looking at the Parthenon, and you're looking at all of those lovely, wonderful temples, you can easily compare it to walking through London and looking at all the monuments and looking at all the trappings of empire. Someone paid for those. And if you just imagine someone coming from the island of Melos or from the Black Sea, walking through Athens in the classical period and seeing the wealth of Athens, they must have felt very similar as a Pakistani walking through London and just thinking about who paid for all of that and what the suffering is that is sort of like underneath all of those riches and all of those, like, yes, there's culture and definitely, but that culture got paid for by something and someone. So there are definitely already in the classical period, there are voices of sort of like counter voices to the democratic sort of like Athenian imperial narrative. And one wonderful example is a text which we normally ascribe, or that's preserved in the corpus of Xenophon, but the author we normally call him the old oligarch, and he's a wonderful figure who's writing a sort of paradoxical treatise about Athenian democracy, and he's doing that from an undemocratic perspective. So he's explaining he sort of explained that democracy, of course, is a wrong thing, so the Athenians get it all wrong. But since they have this democracy, he's going to explain how it works and why the Athenians need to have democracy. And it's a lovely text. And there's a lot of like modern discourses, even about the European Union and bureaucracy, that's coming back in this text. So there's nothing new under the sun. So at some point, this old oligarch is complaining about the fact that if you have a beef with the Athenians, then you need to go to Athens to resolve it. But the problem is that can take months and months because the Athenians have so many holidays. They're never working. So it's always a festival or there's something else or there's a sacrifice or you can't actually do any business in Athens. So it's a bit like going to Brussels and then there's no session of the EU Commission. You have to wait until they're in session. And all that time, you need to stay in a hotel. You need to consume. You need to eat in a restaurant. It's costing a lot of money. And that is actually keeping the Athenian and the Athenian hospitality sector into business. A lovely, lovely text.
Yeah, he's a grumpy guy. But I think it's worth pointing out that although the ordinary people were rather proud of their democracy there and the law courts, they loved their law courts because they all formed the juries and they loved their fleet. Intellectual thinkers on the whole were not Democrats. Plato, Aristotle, they did not like this. And Aristotle's great fear, the worst thing that could happen is the tyranny of the mob, mob rule. So for him, democracy was dangerous.
And what did democracy mean to the Athenians?
Well, I mean, I think it's a set of processes mostly. There are values. There are values of equality. Now, not equality of economic status, not equality of gender, but equality of political opportunity. That is the right to speak, to make proposals, to participate, really. And it wasn't a right. Athenian democracy works so well because it's regarded as this huge privilege and it's a duty. You had to participate. And one of the extraordinary things about it is how many of the members of the democracy would have participated in the everyday running of it. There was no civil service, so there were all sorts of subcommittees of the main part of the parliament, so to speak. That is the assembly.
And who sat in that parliament, in that assembly?
Well, all male citizens over the age of 20. Theoretically, you were a citizen at 18, but you had to do 2 years military service then. Then you had access to the... but that's males, no slaves, no foreigners, no women. So it's, relatively speaking, it's a club. But, I mean, it was a club in all Western societies anyway, until deep into the 20th century in some cases.
And it's interesting that so many countries, and again going back to the United States, explicitly modelled themselves and the kind of systems they developed on Athens.
I think on... Some of the values, but I mean one of the interesting things about the history of Athens is how it fades. It's the importance of its government system fades for almost two centuries, really, till the end of the 19th century. I think when the founding fathers were deciding how they wanted to run their new nation, it was really Rome was more influential. Yeah. I mean the Greek thinkers were important in terms of the basics of political science and, well, Thucydides to some extent, but Plato and Aristotle. But really, it was the Roman Republic that inspired the founding fathers. And you still have like the college, the collegiate system in the American election. That's really taken from the block voting of the Romans. So, and it wasn't then until about 100 years later, by the time you get to Abraham Lincoln, there's a Greek revival. And that is really where serious study of the Athenian democratic or governmental system starts in earnest with one of the great early historians of ancient Greece, George Grote. Interesting, very interesting man. So there's a long kind of silence. There isn't this great beacon, this great democratic beacon in a candle that stays lit through, I don't know, the Byzantine age, the Dark Ages, whatever, it kind of fades from attention, really, until the 19th century, where it's picked up by modern scholarship.
Martin, I wonder, during this period of the Athenian Empire and the Athenian democratic city-state, I wonder, were there opposing voices who talked about the status of women, or who opposed slavery, or who were unhappy with some of the more militaristic policies of the state?
If you focus on gender, then there's something really odd about the content of Athenian tragedies, for example. So we have 38 surviving plays, of the many hundreds, if not thousands, that were performed in the classical period. And most of them have prominent female characters. And actually a large, perhaps the majority of them, actually have female leads or a female chorus. And there's something really odd about that. So on the one hand, women are completely powerless within the society. They are relegated to the domain of the household, the oikos, and are not part of the political sort of sphere of the city. But at the same time, within this political sphere, and definitely the performance of tragedy, which is happening in a festival context, is very much the political sphere, they are representing women and are thinking about gender differences and gender oppositions and about the roles of men and the roles of women. And there's something really interesting about that. So it makes you think that they're thinking about, let's say, male values and male behavior through women, which is quite interesting, actually. Mm.
Do you think it was a little subversive?
There's definitely an aspect of that, yeah. So if you look at the figures that someone like Euripides puts on stage, for example, that's Medea, that is Phaedra, they're very problematic women, but they're problematic to a large extent because they are showing male behavior. They're behaving according to male heroic and civic codes. Mm. And it's causing all kinds of major mayhem, effectively. And it's leading to major disasters, major tragedies within the household, but also within the cities and the societies that these characters are part of.
We've mentioned how nasty and brutal the Athenians could be in some of their conflicts. How extreme was it? Was there ever an element of genocide in what they were pursuing? Was there, Brian, was there ever an element of them going beyond what was acceptable even by the norms of the time?
Well, yes, I think so. Although, I mean, from the sort of dramas that Martina's talking about, at least one of the expectations you were going to face if you were a conquered town, let's say, is that the men and were going to be killed and the women sold into slavery. That certainly comes across as a distinct possibility. So the rules weren't very tight. I suppose the degree of Athenian power in the 5th century is what we're talking about. They had the power to wipe out populations if they wanted. Now, I don't think genocide is probably the right word. What they wanted to do was to stamp on dissent. So when places revolt from the power, from their empire, they sometimes react very ferociously to Mytilene and the great Melian debate in Thucydides about what to do with the island of Melos. And I mean, there's one strand that says, well, wipe them all out. And they just about hold back from wiping the population out. But they kill a lot of people. It's not, you know, we think of the Geneva Convention or something. Things didn't work like that in the ancient world. You kind of did whatever you thought was strategically needed. And if that meant wiping out a small town population, we talk of cities a lot because the Greek word for polis, where we get political, is often translated as city. But there were very few cities. Athens was a city in the sense of size, but I think more rightly should be translated as town in the vast majority of cases. These are small. Most of the states of the Greek world are pretty small, just a few thousand people.
Okay, well, tonight we are debating the history and the legacy of ancient Athens. And we're going to take a very quick break now. And when we come back, I'll be talking to Robin Waterfield and Richard Stoneman. And we'll be continuing our exploration of classical Athens. So stay with us here on News Talk.
Talking history on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the history of Athens. And I'm delighted to be joined on the phone by Dr. Richard Stoneman, who's honorary visiting professor at the University of Exeter and author of the wonderful book, A Traveller's History of Athens. Richard, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I suppose an interesting question maybe to begin with is, what do you think of Athens when it's mentioned?
Well, to me, Athens is the place where human thinking really began. Before the 5th century, there'd been a great deal of scientific work, mathematical speculation, geometrical work in Egypt, and the Babylonians had made great advances in arithmetical sciences and astronomy and observation. But it was the 5th century Athenians who really turned the gaze on themselves and started to reflect on and try to understand the human condition and human behavior.
Is there a danger or a tendency maybe to think that everyone in ancient Athens was a genius, given that there were so many great advances in drama and poetry and literature and philosophy and in maths and astronomy and so on? Was it a city of genius and geniuses?
Well, it attracted geniuses to it. Clearly, there was something in the water, I suppose, that made this kind of philosophical and humanistic speculation particularly attractive to the Athenians. Whether you can lay it directly at the door of the radical democracy that was introduced in the early 5th century is very difficult to determine. But it's certainly true that once people in Athens began to write and think seriously about these matters in history, in philosophy, in drama, and in art, the city attracted people to it from all over the Greek world. That was where you had to come if you wanted to live the life of the mind, even for part of the time.
I'm fascinated by the developments in drama in ancient Greece, and I wonder how significant and how important a figure was Sophocles to the development of theatre.
Well, Sophocles is, to my mind, the greatest of the three great Greek dramatists, but he was preceded, of course, by Aeschylus, who really forged the form of Greek tragedy and established all kinds of things like the number of actors and the way that the plays were staged, and introduced the chorus to its fullest extent, because before Aeschylus there'd been a very simple kind of form of, well, barely theatre really, more like performances on a cart. But Aeschylus made it into a real art form with a theatre, stage, and an orchestra where the chorus would dance and perform and sing their often rather abstruse philosophical lyrics at the same time as they danced. And then Sophocles took the form a little bit further, introduced the third actor, which made it much more flexible, because as I'm sure you know, all the actors were masked, all the parts were played by men, so if you had only three actors, you could play a considerable number of parts on stage, but not all at the same time. So it was nothing like the modern drama where you can have dozens of attendant lords coming in and out. It was only the chorus of 12 in the case of tragedy, 50 in the case of comedy, that was there in any numbers.
And Richard, the concept of Greek tragedy, it's so resilient. People still describe certain events, certain things as a Greek tragedy. Why has it been such an important concept?
Well, you have to remember that the Greek drama was also a religious performance in honour of the god Dionysus. And the word tragedy originally means a song for the goat being the animal that is sacrificed to Dionysus. So in its origins, the word tragedy has nothing tragic about it. It simply refers to the physical or social circumstances of the performance. But obviously, by the time of Aristotle, if not even sooner, tragedy had come to carry the connotations that it has today. And the reason for that is very simply that the writers like Aeschylus and Sophocles and Euripides looked quite unblinkingly at the human condition, at the position of men vis-à-vis the gods, and were able to observe and depict in all its vividness the most extreme human emotions, the state of human beings under pressure. Aristotle said that the purpose of tragedy was to evoke pity and terror and thereby to purify those emotions. There's been a few millennia of speculation as to what exactly he meant by all that, but nonetheless, the most terrifying things do happen in Greek tragedy. The most extreme cases of revenge, of self-mutilation, of hideous murders. And the key to it seems to me that in all these cases, the human being is coming up against a universe that won't budge. The universe is represented by the gods, and the gods will do what they will, and they're not going to make any concessions to what humans want, even when those humans are particular honorers of those gods. In the case of Euripides Hippolytus, who is extreme in his devotion to the virgin goddess Artemis and rejects altogether the life of love and sex and the goddess Aphrodite. As you probably know, his stepmother falls in love with him, tries to persuade him to make love to her, and then when she fails, accuses him of trying to seduce her, with the result that Hippolytus's own father drives him to his death by praying to the god Poseidon to send a bull from the sea to destroy him as he rides his chariot on the beach. And as Hippolytus lies dying on the beach, he prays to the goddess Artemis. Artemis appears to him, and she says, in the end, her final words are, "As a god, I cannot look on a dying person. I have to go now. So long." Human beings are on their own. The universe doesn't care. And that, I think, is the ultimate meaning of Greek tragedy. And it really hasn't changed over two millennia.
And finally, Richard, a question about philosophy. When we look at the history of philosophy and the development of rational thought, how much do we owe to Socrates, Plato and Aristotle?
Everything is a nice, simple answer to that. Because before 5th century Athens, as I said, there was scientific speculation of various kinds in various parts of the ancient world, but it was the 5th century thinkers like Thucydides started to look at human nature and try to understand the wellsprings of human behavior. And the Hippocratic writers tried to look at the behavior of diseases in the human body and to see what lessons could be learned from them, not so much to cure anything, but simply to know a little better what was going to happen when it happened again, because it would. And then Socrates came along, and the question that he asked was, what do I know? And he came to the conclusion that the only thing he knew was that he knew nothing.
Okay, well, Richard, thanks a million for joining us tonight. Dr. Richard Stoneman, author of the wonderful book A Traveller's History of Athens, thank you for taking us on a journey around ancient Athens.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more Talking History on the history of Athens right after this break.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate Athens, the history of a city. I'm delighted to be joined on the phone by Robin Waterfield. He's an independent scholar and translator and the author of the brilliant book Athens, a History, From Ancient Ideal to Modern City. He's also the co-editor of the Oxford University Press series Ancient Warfare and Civilization. Robin, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you, Patrick.
Can we talk about, I suppose, the place of Athens in terms of wider Greek history? Because it seems to occupy that central position.
Well, it does. And in a way, that's slightly unfortunate. I mean, ancient Greece, as you know, consisted of, over 1,000 little city-states. But Athens was one of two or three very large ones. And as a result, it started to sort of absorb local dependencies. It became very big and wealthy. And so it occupies, and also because it was a center of culture, therefore, a lot more writing, ancient Greek writing, is about Athens than anywhere else. A lot of ancient Greek drama and so on comes from Athens rather than anywhere else. And as a result, a great deal of our evidence for ancient history tends to be actually evidence for Athens and not for the wider ancient Greece, not for, you know, all the other thousand little city-states. So it was very important, and we know more about ancient Greek history as a result of Athens than anywhere else, but with that slightly unfortunate twist to it.
Even the subtitle of your book, The Idea of the Ancient Ideal, that's the image that we have of Athens. We talk about Athenian democracy. We see it as having this rich intellectual culture. Like, how true is that?
Oh, absolutely spot on. I mean, it was the first place where drama was developed, where history writing was developed, where a lot of the where biography was developed, where, you know, where a lot of the European tradition stems from Athens and Athens alone from among all the ancient Greek cities.
And when we talk about, I suppose, things like the contribution of ancient Greece and the contribution of ancient Athens to democracy, how different was it from modern ideas about democracy?
Well, the foundation, the basic principles of democracy were invented by ancient Athens. The idea that officers should be accountable, the idea of transparency, the idea of one man, one vote. But there you see, there we come across the first difference between ancient Athenian democracy and ours today, is that it was very strictly one man, one vote. Women weren't allowed to vote. Of all the, let's say, ancient Athens at its height had a population, let's say, of around 340,000. But of those, only 50,000 would have actually been allowed to play a part in the democratic process. But that is the real big difference between the practice of ancient democracy. The ideas are the same, but the practice is very different, because ancient Athens was a relatively small place, and it was possible for, when I say one man, one vote, for every single citizen of Athens to actually go to an assembly and make his voice heard. And that's something we can't do, because we live in larger countries. We get close to that with referendums, but other than that, we don't really have one man, one vote in that direct way. We elect representatives to speak and act for us in parliament, but in ancient Athens they did it themselves.
Why was Socrates put to death? Because that's always held up as a criticism of Athenian democracy.
Well, I don't think it should. I mean, I think by the light of Athenian democracy at the time, they were quite right to put him to death. He had some rather undemocratic political ideas. For instance, he completely, a great many positions in the ancient Athenian democracy were filled by a lottery. There was a long list of volunteers for posts, and then a lottery, as it were, the gods, decided who was actually chosen. Socrates poo-pooed that idea. He said, you know, you wouldn't choose your athletes by a lottery. You wouldn't. So he was pushing the idea that politicians should be experts, that Athens shouldn't be run by amateurs, which in a sense, of course, it was. I mean, that was one of the principles of Athenian democracy. But if he'd just had these a few, you know, eccentric, undemocratic political ideas, then they would have just dismissed him as an eccentric. I mean, you know, there were lots of thinkers in ancient Athens at the time and promoting all sorts of weird and wonderful ideas. But Socrates also had a lot of very unfortunate friends. At the end of the 5th century, Athens was involved in this terrible war with Sparta, and this disturbed Athenian society a great deal. So there were two occasions when oligarchs took over, when democracy was temporarily dissolved and in favor of a greater or lesser oligarchy. And that happened twice, in 411 and immediately after the war in 404. And a lot of the people involved in those oligarchies were friends of Socrates. They were members of even of his circle of people who you know, came to him to hear what he had to say. And one in particular, the oligarchy that ran Athens from 404 to 403, was very brutal. It was horrible. It was the first regime that made one afraid of the dawn raid in your house. They arrested and executed 1,500 people, and the leader of these bloodthirsty people was a close associate of Socrates. So that oligarchy didn't last long. It got put down. And after that, it was, I think, really only a matter of time before somebody took Socrates to court. And he was indeed taken to court by three prominent Democrats. So, as I say, I think by the lights of the democracy at the time, they were probably right to put him to death.
So what are the sources like, and do we rely on a select number to get our sense of what was happening in Athens?
Well, we rely on all we can. It really depends what period of history one is talking about. I mean, for instance, the period that I'm writing about at the moment, the 3rd century BC, the sources are basically non-existent. There is no historical narrative in existence for much of the 3rd century. To classical Athens, what most people think of when we speak of Athens, then we have very good sources. We have two great historians writing in the 5th century, both Herodotus and Thucydides were writing in Athens in the 5th century. And then we've got a huge number of inscriptions. We've got a number of 4th century historians, quite a large number of speeches that were delivered usually in court cases in Athens, which are full of insights about society and about how the political system works and things like that. We've got very good sources for Athens. Going back to something we were talking about earlier, this slightly distorts our evidence for ancient Greece as a whole, because we have such good evidence for Athens and such poor evidence for everywhere else. So we tend to assume that Athens is typical in certain ways when it might not be, because it might be bigger and richer and so on than a lot of the other places. But the sources, yes, they can be very patchy indeed. And then, you know, it's like trying to create a jigsaw puzzle out of not very many pieces.
When some of them are missing. Okay, well, Robin, thank you so much for joining us tonight for our discussion about Athens.
Okay, Patrick, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
We'll be back with more Talking History and more on the history of Athens after this break.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History with me, Patrick Egan. I'm enjoying our discussion tonight on ancient Athens and finding an awful lot about the culture, about the architecture, about the philosophy, about the literature, about the empire and about Athenian democracy. I'm delighted to be rejoined by Dr. Martin Kuipers and Professor Brian McGing. Before the break there, we were talking to Richard Stoneman and we also heard from Robin Waterfield. And I'm also delighted to be joined now by George Saranikolaou, the author of Facing Athens, Encounters with the Modern City. George, I'll start back with you. And it's very interesting when we look at the contribution that Athens has made to the modern world. And it has had a very strong, powerful legacy, as much as for the image of Athens and what it represented, as much as for anything else. But when you look at Athens today, I wonder what inspiration or what points should we take by looking back from the past, and maybe what can we see in terms of where Athens should go in the future?
Well, you know, that legacy is both a boon and a burden to modern Greeks, modern Athenians. They're quite proud of that history and that legacy. You know, they can look up and see the Acropolis from many points in the city, and that's a constant reminder. But I think that, you know, Athens is a modern city with very many modern problems. And I think that that ancient history and legacy provides a kind of fortitude to Athenians. But like, you know, people in other large cities in the world, they need to deal with their modern, current, contemporary problems.
Brian, can I ask you about maybe the legacy of Athenian democracy today in the 21st century, as we are thinking about our own democracies in Ireland and around the world, and we are seeing problems with those democracies, the rise of populism, the problem of fake news, threats to the very democratic systems that we value so much. Are there lessons that we can take from the Athenians?
Well, I think there are, yes. You have to start by recognising that there is a great difference, of course, between a direct democracy, which is what the Athenians were, that is, everybody in it made all the decisions collectively, and the representative democracy that now is the norm, where we elect people to make those decisions. So it's quite a difference. Some people think it's so different that the word democracy shouldn't be used for both. But I don't, actually. I think fundamentally this is how this is about the will of the majority of the people, and how, whether you do that directly or whether you select or elect a group to carry out the will. It seems to me that it is actually the same animal. The Athenians got a lot right. I mean, taking into account what we were talking about earlier, the exclusion of women, slavery and so on, which is, as I was saying, exactly the same as the founding fathers in America and in the 18th century. If you leave that aside, I mean, if you start saying, well, you can't compare that world with this because it's just so different, I don't accept that either. We're not trying to say that things are exactly the same, but there are some messages, I think. I mean, some economists, some historical economists maintain that GDP levels in the classical Greek, classical Athenian democracy weren't reached again in Greece until 1925, that's a disputable figure, needless to say, or 9% of the population owned 35% of the wealth. It's a very, very low level of wealth inequality by modern standards. You can argue, and I think it's an effective argument, that they got quite a lot right. And if that's the case, then I think you can start saying, well, what did they get right? And you can look at the institutions. I think it's possible for institutions or for societies to have a sort of economic efflorescence without having the free institutions of Athens. But I think at the same time they are fundamental. Something like oversight. Our politicians say, of course, and quite right, that they have to go back to the people every 5 years. But in Athens, you were in office for 1 year. You had to be vetted before entering that. You could then be challenged during that, and you had to provide accounts at the end. And you could be prosecuted for doing all sorts of things, including making false promises, in which case our door, I suspect, would be empty. They'd all be in prison. So there was a very high level, actually, of oversight. And I think we have a very low level of oversight, actually. The oversight is largely in our society provided by the free press, not so much by the parliament, it seems to me. Theoretically, it should be the case, but with the party whip system, you're not going to get same party people.
So, Brian, is what you're saying that there should also then be a greater responsibility on the citizens, that they should be more involved year so that there's this greater accountability, greater transparency, and that you know what's happening?
Absolutely. I think accountability and oversight is one area. The other is participation. I mean, that is a big worry. Now, we've had a couple of referendums that have been very successful, largely because young people have got much more involved. But we also have had, 20 referendums before that, with some of them turn out at 30%. And I counted, I think half of them were less than 50%. So participation is absolutely crucial, it seems to me. And that was what Athenian democracy was about. Aristotle says being a citizen was about two things, ruling and being ruled in turn. You took turns. So a huge percent of the men, obviously, the members of the Athenian democracy, actually participated in the business of government. And we have a system where we elect others to do that. But that's always been the difficulty with that model of citizenship that people actually can check out and just not take part.
Martin, do you think that it's a positive legacy that ancient Athens has left us?
Yeah, I think that's very, very true. So it's very difficult to look at the history of Western literature, for example, and not land in classical Athens. So I, for example, my own research is more, say, post-classical. But in my teaching, I have to come back constantly to the classical period. It is the cradle of democracy. It is the cradle of historiography, the cradle of drama, comedy, tragedy, of oratory, which we haven't really discussed very much. It's very difficult to sort of to write the history of Western culture without spending a lot of time thinking about classical Athens. And however you might want to think of that, and whether you sort of emphasize, you think that Athens is special or Athens is problematic in many ways, we can problematize many of the aspects of Athenian democracy and of Athenian imperialism, etc. It is a fact that it is not possible to actually teach the history of Western culture without landing in Athens.
And Brian, a final question. Is it an accident that all of these things came together in Athens at that time, that you had this flourishing of literature and philosophy and politics and culture and architecture and oratory? Or is it just that each one fed into the other and that there was this synergy or what was happening?
Yeah, so that's a big sort of question that my favourite historian Polybius might have addressed an accident. Yes, I mean, things do come together. There is an economic flourishing. One of my PhD students recently finished looking at the Athenian naval economy. Published a good book on the subject, which provided a huge engine to the economy. Enormous. You're building an entire fleet of warships and maintaining them. An enormous impact on the economy. And how do these things work? Yes, why do you suddenly get writers who are and have remained iconic? When you look back into the 8th and 7th centuries, you can see things developing in Athens in a particular way. But they developed in similar ways to some extent in other cities, like Syracuse, an enormously rich, powerful city in Sicily. They had a democracy as well, where we know less about it. But it's interesting, there wasn't that much. Democracy wasn't suddenly flavour of the day. Nobody, they didn't all go rushing to it. There are other democracies that we know of, but not necessarily the great model at the time. But now, I think very important system to examine and see what we can learn.
Excellent. Well, I think that's a brilliant point on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to my wonderful panel of experts, Dr. Martine Kuipers and Professor Brian McGing. We also heard from Robin Waterfield, author of Athens, A History, and Dr. Richard Stoneman, author of A Traveller's History of Athens. And we were also honoured to be joined by George Saranikolaou, author of Facing Athens, Encounters with the Modern City. That does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cattle, my producer, and Chris Bent on sound. Next week for the August bank holiday, well, we'll be continuing with the political theme and we'll be bringing you back our show on the First Thal, because we commemorated the centenary of that this year, and we'll be talking about the men and women who were involved in the early years of the Irish democratic state. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.
Talking history on News Talk.